Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version
Good Monday
of the program.
Morning. Welcome
the show
to
is
the
one
show
of our original
Phoenix.
Productions. It's a curated
and I'm Steve
program of
coming
news
up this
and features
morning
from Phoenix and the
and
state, along with national and international
in
stories.
And
you can also
and
find
Kathleen
segments
Kennedy
and additional information
in
at theshow.kjzz.org.
But first, the State Department
Thanks
of Water Resources has rejected a proposal from APS to use groundwater in the Buckeye area to cool the Palo Verde Nuclear Generating Station. The quality of the water in question is considered poor, but opponents of APS plan argue that it's already used by residents. APS does have 30 days to appeal this denial. Joining us with more is Arizona Republic's Ryan Randazzo. Ryan, good morning.
Morning.
So let's flesh out a little bit what the water in Buckeye is really like, even before we get to APS.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because there are parts of Buckeye where there's so much groundwater that they actually have to drain it in order to grow crops. So this is a really agricultural part of the state. So they pump quite a bit of this water and put it into the normally dry Gila Riverbed, and it flows downstream. APS was saying, hey, since you basically dump this water, and they characterize that as a waste, since you're dumping this water anyways, why don't we pump some of it? And they wanted to use it to cool the nuclear power plant, which right now gets all of its water from a wastewater treatment plant.
So we alluded to this a bit in the introduction, but what is the issue surrounding this? Why is there a problem behind what APS is trying to do?
Well, the Buckeye Irrigation District opposed this. They were afraid that the nuclear plant would pump so much water that it would affect the wells that they use to irrigate the crops. So first they have to dry the soil, and then they pump more water for the crops down there. And they contested APS's characterization of this as poor quality. It was a specific kind of permit that APS was going after that said it's poor quality water with no other use. Well, the state found there actually are people living down there pumping this water for their own homes, and they're not treating it, so they're using it for household use, they're using it for dairies down there, so it's not necessarily as poor quality as the APS application made it out to be.
Where is APS getting the water now for Palo Verde?
So Palo Verde is the only nuclear plant in the country that's not situated on a river or the ocean. They get all of the cooling water from the 91st Avenue wastewater treatment plant, so that's basically all of the reclaimed water from Phoenix, Mesa, and other cities in the region.
Water that, in theory, could also have other uses, right?
That's right. And when they renewed their contract to use that wastewater, there were people that opposed that, and they said exactly what you said, that water could be used for development, and there are other uses for this water than a giant nuclear plant, the biggest in the country.
Is this something that generally gets lost, Ryan, when it comes to water usage? We've talked about in the past with solar plants being built, the fact that to have water to cool any of these plants, obviously nuclear included, is something that costs quite a bit. Is this something that has come up at all in the argument, just the discussion of why groundwater would be used for this versus trying to pump a different sort of water, for example?
Yeah, I mean, the cost of water is going to go up as the state grows and we have more people here. And APS, which runs the nuclear plant, they realize this. And that cost is maybe going to make that nuclear plant uneconomical 20 years down the road from now. So they want to operate for a long time. They're licensed to run into the 2040s, and they're talking about a relicensing, which would take them into the 2060s. But they might not be able to afford that treated wastewater in those later years, so they're starting to look for alternatives so that the plant is not shut like the coal plant that we've spent so much time talking about recently.
How has APS responded to this denial?
I personally was a little surprised because you don't see APS lose a lot, and especially lose at the state level. This is a state agency, director appointed by the governor, and for them to say no to APS, frankly, I was a little bit surprised. They didn't have much of a reaction. They got the letter last week that said, you can't do this. They have 30 days to appeal. They're likely to do that. They're considering it, but they don't give me a big emotional reaction to things like this. So.
What might change in an appeal? What does the appeal process in a case like this entail?
Well, the state's main objection was that the water is already in use. And so APS could come back with a hydrologic study, I suppose, that says where they're pumping the water would not affect these nearby wells. But the state found these other wells within 2 miles of where APS wants to drill. And APS also would need more than this initial well that they applied for to pump the quantity that they're seeking. So they put in an application for one well, but the quantity of water they need in the future, they would have to be applying for more. So it might be a tough argument, and these things get extremely complicated when you're talking about the water underground and which way it flows and what the quality is. So it'll be an interesting debate.
Ryan, terrific reporting on that as usual. We have about a minute left, and I don't want to blindside you, but I'm really curious. There was controversy over the weekend related to APS's retired CEO, Don Brandt, related to what sort of consulting salary he's going to get. Do you think there's anything to follow up on that? Is this just an aspect of people frustrated with APS and how it spends money, that Don Brandt was a controversial figure? Anything more to that, you think, to come?
Well, there's just general displeasure with that utility right now because of its rates, because of its shutoff policies, because of its participation in elections. And then to see them apply for this new rate case and say, hey, we're going to have a new CEO, we're really turning a new leaf, but then, well, we're actually going to pay the old CEO to stay on for a while. It just doesn't sit very well with people. I don't think it's surprising. I mean, you probably want that expertise, especially as you're going through a contested rate hike, but it just is not going to sit well with the folks that are opposing the rate increase that APS just proposed.
Okay. Ryan Randazzo of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central, thank you as always.
Thanks a lot.
All eyes will be on Washington, D.C. this week as the House begins public hearings in their impeachment inquiry into President Trump. But on the same day those hearings are scheduled to start, the president will be welcoming a world leader to D.C. That's one of the top international stories in the coming days. And with me to talk about some of them is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. So, Rob, let's start with that meeting. Who is coming to town?
Yes, Mark. Well, we have the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, expected to be in the capital that day to meet with President Trump. Now, along with all the big issues in Mr. Trump's entree, including the trade war with China, the impeachment inquiry involving Ukraine, and so on, Turkey is a big and important international issue for the US right now. And that's because of the conflict in northern Syria, just across Turkey's southern border. Until recently, your listeners may remember, the US had troops in this area. Their abrupt withdrawal gave Turkey license to invade the territory, which it says was being used by Kurdish terrorist groups. It wanted, it said, to create a buffer zone along that border, on the southern edge of that border. Those Kurdish groups, by the way, had been US allies in the fight against the Islamic State group. So the US withdrawal was very contentious, to say the least.
All right, so this is obviously a complex political visit, but it seems like there's also a complicated personal relationship between the two leaders. Is that right?
Yeah, so they've had a bit of an up and down roller coaster personal relationship, these two. So President Trump instituted financial sanctions on Turkey over the fate of a detained U.S. pastor. Those sanctions really hit Turkey's economy and upset President Erdogan. Likewise, Turkey decided to buy a Russian air defense system, which is complicated not least because Turkey is a fellow member of NATO with the U.S. So there was an issue of skepticism over Turkish loyalty. How loyal was Turkey to a fellow NATO member like the U.S.? The U.S. opposed that deal with Russia big time, and Mr. Erdogan would like to diffuse tension with Mr. Trump on that issue. And there's the letter, Mark. You might remember that President Trump sent Mr. Erdogan a letter asking him not to invade Syria, saying, "Don't be a tough guy, don't be a fool." Well, some reports suggested Mr. Erdogan read that letter and in a fit of anger promptly tossed it into the bin. So you see, we don't quite know what kind of relations we'll see on Wednesday, but certainly in the past they've been pretty bumpy.
All right, something certainly to keep our eyes on. Rob, let's move on a bit from politics. On Friday, a test run of the world's longest commercial flight. Where exactly is that going?
Well, Mark, this is going from London to Sydney, Australia, and is expected to take about 20 hours. Imagine being in a plane for 20 hours. Your listeners may have heard about an earlier test flight in October from New York to Sydney, which took just over 19 hours. That was conducted by the airline Qantas. Here's the captain of that plane, Sean Golding.
We're researching the effects of the long flights, the ultra-long-haul flying on our crews. We're getting a lot of data that's going to be analysed over the coming weeks and months. That flight last night was 16,200 kilometres. We were airborne for 19 hours and 16 minutes, and we landed here in Sydney with a comfortable 70 minutes of fuel. And that was also against stronger headwinds than we'd actually forecast. So that was a success.
Imagine arriving with a comfortable 70 minutes of fuel left in your tanks. I'm not sure how comfortable that sounds to me. But these flights, as he says, you know, they're about testing the impact on people, but also their economic viability. One of my colleagues here at the BBC actually will be making the London to Sydney flight this week, so we'll see what he says. But various experiments are happening, like designing exercise breaks on board, dealing with the lighting on board, and even what kind of food to feed passengers and when they should be fed it. And there's a need to think about the flight time for pilots as well, because there are currently limits to how many hours a flight crew can work. So these extra long-haul flights push the limit of what's considered safe.
But Rob, aren't there also environmental concerns over such long flights?
Yes, there are concerns over flying, period, but it's complicated. An industry group did a survey and found that 270,000 passengers flew between Los Angeles and Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam in a year, for instance. But there are no direct flights between those two cities, so those passengers made connections in places like China or Japan, and the up and down of those extra flights may be more polluting, it turns out, than a direct flight.
All right, Rob. So there's been a lot of protest around the world in the past few weeks. We've seen it in places from Hong Kong to Chile. But one protest movement will be marking its first anniversary this coming weekend. What's that?
Yeah, so this is the Gilets Jaunes, or Yellow Vests, of France, and they'll be marking 1 year. Your listeners might remember the protest movement, the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vests, began in response to an increase in taxes on gasoline. And angry drivers responded by putting their high-vis, their high-visibility vests, in their car windows. Well, it's developed into a nationwide protest by people who say they're the forgotten middle class, the people who can't, they say, for example, afford to live in big cities.
But these protests also turned violent, right?
Yeah, so what began with vandalizing speed cameras turned into weekly riots in the French capital and elsewhere. Police fired tear gas and protesters set fire to anything they could light. There's been a lot of debate in the Yellow Vest movement, actually. There's no established leadership in that movement. And many people who took part at first are now concerned that the symbols of the movement have been taken over by radical elements. So that's been the first year of the Yellow Vest. We'll have to see what happens in the second year.
All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, as always, good to talk to you. Thank you.
And to you, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Still to come, a new app aimed at kids is supposed to help them track how much they eat. But there are concerns this weight-watching app could lead to unhealthy relationships with food.
I have seen enough children over the years that they are so different, and we have to be very careful when we discuss this, and that some kids really should never be tracking their food and monitoring their food.
Forming healthy habit eating habits for kids.
But first, we're going to check in with the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. It's a weekly segment where we talk about current issues facing the state and the nation, featured in columns on the newspaper's op-ed pages. Tempe marked an important anniversary over the weekend as Tempe Town Lake turned 20 years old. It's become a huge part of the city's landscape, but the process of getting it started was not an easy one. As a reporter, Phil Boas was present at the creation and is with me for his weekly appearance to talk about it. Phil, what was it like to get this going, even from a logistical standpoint?
So it really begins in 1967 with an architecture class at ASU, and the dean of the architecture school puts a challenge before his students. What can you do with this scar that we call the Salt River bed? Mm-hmm. You know, make it something that is we can enjoy and appreciate. And that eventually led to an effort that it was going to be metro-wide to redevelop the Salt River and bring it back, restore the wetlands that are there. Only Tempe voters went for it and voted for it. And it happened because Tempe voters were more progressive than the rest of Metro Phoenix, and for a reason, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, is because they got to build out first. So they had to build up, and they had to start doing things that in a different way to be unique and to create charm in their community. And so they went for this. They went for the Rio Salado, and they created Town Lake, and it didn't happen overnight.
Yeah, take us through that. So there was former Mayor Harry Mitchell was heavily involved. Former Mayor Neil Giuliano was involved, others as well.
Yeah, I think Harry Mitchell and Neil Giuliano are probably the two essential people in this, and Harry Mitchell especially, who's there at the creation, because he really had to push forward a vision for the city of Tempe, and he was already doing it for the downtown. He was the guy who moved that. In fact, he was hard-nosed and hard-headed. People used to call him a benevolent dictator, and I covered him at the time. I was a cub reporter at that time, and he was a tough guy. You know, he had a vision, and he was going to push through, and the press had better not get in the way. That was for sure. I felt that. So, but anyways, so what they had to do first, and a few people know this, understand it today, who enjoy Town Lake, is you had to channelize that river. You had to go in and dig deeper and put in cement so you could create it to create this protective barrier from flooding. Because otherwise, if you put buildings up there and you didn't have this, you know, you get your 100-year flood, and pretty soon State Farm is up to their years in water. So that had to be done first, and that was a huge effort. They got a lot of money donated to be able to do it, contributions from the federal government, Maricopa County, you know, and that took a lot of effort to pull off.
Yeah. And now, of course, Mark Mitchell is mayor and carrying on what his dad wanted, I suppose.
Yeah, and to Neil Giuliano's credit, I mean, he comes along and he has to carry through the vision. And now what is happening is you're getting a lot of opposition that's starting to build up. We're spending this money. Why? And why? How come nobody wants to build next to our beautiful new centerpiece? You know, what's going on, Neil? And why should we continue to do this and waste money and burn money? And Neil kept it going. And it wouldn't have happened if you didn't have somebody with that kind of push making it happen. So
let's move. Just a few years ago, Senator John McCain was heavily involved. One of the things he wanted to do is this Rio Reimagined and this sort of thing, be heavily involved in that. Tell us about the conversation you and the editorial board had with him a few years ago.
Well, what a revelation it was for one of the ASU folks was telling me that John McCain's great passion now is it's not foreign affairs. It's the Rio Reimagined. It's the Rio Salado. What? You're kidding. Okay, so he comes in for an editorial board meeting. We're ready to ask him about this. We didn't need to because he was so eager to talk about it. And he had seen what Tempe had accomplished, and he wanted to go great guns and make sure that the rest of the valley continued to do this. And this created the stirring for Rio Reimagined, which is going to be the push for a generation to really take what Tempe has done and pull it right across through all of these communities that line the Salt River and really tie together the Indian community and all of these different cities that are along the riverbed there. And create vitality, create a great good place where people can go and do things, have, you know, what they do at Town Lake. They have firework displays and they have weddings and they're sculling on the river. You know, it's pretty neat.
So McCain wanted Rio Reimagined to be a big part of his legacy then.
Right. He saw it as a legacy project. And so I started telling him, you know, but, you know, he was talking about the economics. And I was telling him, you know, the great thing about Rio Salado, the Salt River, it's our creation story. That's where it all began. If it isn't for that river and it isn't for the Native Americans that came along and created canals from there, cultivated anywhere from 100,000 to 250,000 acres of what we know as Metro Phoenix before Columbus got here, and they did it with canals. Had that not happened, we don't have Phoenix. And so anyways, we do this meeting. McCain goes off to make a video with one of our news people. And I'm in my office, and a moment later, you know, he comes back. He circled back. He came back to my office. He says, hey, I want to talk to you about the history of the Rio Salado. So I want to make an appointment to do that. I never saw him again after that. I mean, he was struggling with terminal illness, and so we never got the chance to have that discussion. But Kate Gallego, the mayor of Phoenix, is writing about it in Viewpoints, the meaning, the history of this place, and how it gives us a sense of place and understanding of who we are. And if there's anything that we in Phoenix crave, it's that, is understanding who we are and what is this place. Rio Salado tells us.
Yeah, really something to tie our past and our present together.
Right.
Okay. Phil, thanks.
Sure.
Phil Boas is editorial director of the Arizona Republic.
The number of international students enrolling in U.S. universities has been on the decline over the past year. For Arizona's public universities, there has been a significant drop over the last several years. The majority of international students here come from China, followed by India and Saudi Arabia. The Arizona Republic reports ASU's international enrollment is on the decline for the third year in a row. So what's behind that decline, and what does this mean for universities here and across the country? To tell us more about it, we're joined by Karen Fisher, senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Hello, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. So generally speaking, when did we start seeing this decline in international students enrolling in American colleges and universities?
Overall, we haven't actually seen a decline in the total number of students, but for the last 2 years, two full years, we've seen declines in new international students, and we're about to see new numbers out probably in about a week. And I think there's people are anticipating we're going to see declines again in new students coming to the U.S.
Is this the kind of thing where it's not just one factor behind this? There's a lot of potential reasons.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think a lot of the narrative is around what sort of people loosely call the Trump effect, because the timing for the declines does kind of dovetail with the administration. And I think certainly things like the travel ban and changes in visa policy, and just rhetorically sort of the United States sort of how appealing and welcoming it seems to international students is having an effect, but it is a lot more things from demographics and the countries where these students are coming from to competition from other countries that are becoming more attractive to students, to cost, to even things like safety and how safe families feel about sending their students to study in the U.S.
Karen, you mentioned competition. Have other countries sort of upped their games and tried to get themselves more attractive, whether in certain fields or others?
Yeah, absolutely. Probably the country that's become the most competitive and really benefited from some of these drops in American enrollments has been Canada. And it's really been very intentionally, Canadian universities have been very intentionally saying to students from overseas, look, we're welcoming. This is a friendly country. It's safe. It's cheaper generally than most American universities. And also one thing I failed to mention is it can be easier to come and to stay and have a pathway to immigration if you come as a student in Canada.
So it's not necessarily that international students are staying at home. It's they're going to universities in other countries, just not the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are staying home. You're seeing, for example, one of the biggest or the biggest, in fact, center of international students abroad is China, and it's been making a lot of progress and investing a lot in its own universities. So some of those students are staying at home, but many of them are going to other countries as well.
What is this doing to American universities? I would imagine some of them are taking somewhat of a financial hit.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at this demographic boom, it was really fortuitous for American universities and particularly for public universities, because the real growth in international students happened just with right at the last recession. And so it's really not much of a stretch to say that international students and the tuition dollars they bring really helped to balance the budgets for a number of institutions. You can see declines in state funding, and it you can see growth in international students, particularly at public universities, and they kind of mirror each other. And so I think particularly as, you know, universities worry, and I think we all worry, is, you know, are we going to, inevitably there's going to be another recession. Will we not have international students, or will universities not have international students to help pay the bills?
And Karen, certainly public and private universities have different challenges, different approaches. Are there certain things that universities can do to counteract this? Could it be cyclical? Are there ideas that are being bandied about?
I think it's sort of a yes and approach that institutions are taking. And so I followed a recruiter around last year, going to kind of a traditional market in India, which has been very promising always for its number two after China. And, you know, this recruiter was really trying to say to this admissions officer, yes, we're still welcoming and sort of doubling down. You see colleges going to places where maybe they had not recruited students from before that seem promising. You see colleges kind of trying to be a little bit more intentional and say, what are our strengths and what do we really offer? Are we a big university that's going to give them a lot of options, and or are we really strong in this particular field and that might appeal to students? Or are we a small liberal arts college and thus, you know, you are going to have a one-on-one relationship with your professors? And so I think you're seeing a lot of colleges step back and say, what's my strategy and how do I best present myself to these students and their families?
Karen, before we let you go quickly, do you see any reason why this trend would reverse in the next year or two?
I don't want to be Pollyannish. I mean, I think if anything is going to improve things, it's because universities and colleges are being more intentional and being more strategic. And I think it's important to say, not every institution is seeing decline. Some institutions are continuing to have lots of international students come and be very attractive. You know, they have name brands, and so that may sustain them. But I do think that there are a number of headwinds from demographics to immigration to visa policy that are really going to make it a much more challenging environment for American colleges to recruit abroad.
All right. That is Karen Fisher, senior reporter with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Karen, thank you.
Thanks so much.
For many, civil discussion and a knowledge of civics and American history are a combination that is required to move the nation forward and protect and preserve its traditional institutions. That involves bringing sides with disparate views together even as they disagree. Recently, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, daughter of Robert Kennedy and the former Maryland Lieutenant Governor, was in the Valley to talk about civil conversation as part of ASU's School of Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership. I spoke with her then and began the conversation by asking whether civil discussion and bipartisan cooperation were still possible.
I believe it is. I think it is. We need innovation. We need people to think anew and act anew, as Lincoln would say, because the country is desperate for all of us to talk with one another, to hear one another, to listen to each other, and to be open to the goodness that lies in each other's soul.
As far as innovation goes, in some cases, this may sound contradictory. Maybe innovation is sort of going back to what worked before that we haven't used for a while.
Well, I don't think that's really possible because we're a different country than we were 20 years ago or 30 years ago. We're much more, as you could say, diverse in the sense that we have had, thanks to my father and my uncle, a much more different view of who we are. They passed the 1965 Immigration Act, which meant that we could bring people from all over the world, from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America. It used to be all European. And the good news, as you see in Arizona, the breadth and of our diversity. We all feel that we belong to this country and we have a sense of belonging, and then which means that we need to understand each other. We need to appreciate the talents that each of us brings, and we need to be open to what each of us, who each of us are, whether I'm Irish American or Mexican American or Nigerian American, and then say, I'm also Arizona and whatever, and be happy with that. We can celebrate. There's many parts to ourselves.
Do those of us who feel that way need to be more outspoken about it? Because there are some who would say, you know, based on the current administration, obviously some people love it, many people don't. The fear is that there has been more of a tone set that is less traditionally American in that sense. And people may complain on Twitter, they may complain elsewhere, but are we doing enough in our communities to sort of counteract that?
I think we basically could do a lot more. I mean, you know, my grandmother would tell me how when she was 16 years old, there were signs in Boston that said, help wanted, no Irish need apply. So two generations before me, there was enormous hatred of the people that I was, you know, the Boston Protestants hated us. You would think we came from the same island, and still they hated us. What you are is in the eye of the beholder, and I think what makes America great is that we can accept others and say they aren't the other, but also recognize that everybody has so much to bring, and you can belong in many different communities.
Is that done through communities, or is that done, can we count on politicians to sort of channel us and channel what their communities want?
Politicians often reflect what the community wants, and so it really does come from the culture of the community. And I think Arizona has done a terrific job. I'm so impressed by the people of Arizona, the people at Arizona State, who are saying, we're innovative, we can all get along with one another, we can learn together, we can produce. I don't know what you politicians are doing, trying to fight with one another, but really, we are really good at making things happen.
Tell me more about why you're involved with this specifically, because I had the chance the last couple of years to interview very well-known people, both sides of the aisle, and the thought has been at least, hey, let's engage in this. What are your thoughts on that?
My thought is, you know, Senator John Kyle great Republican senator from Arizona, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, former lieutenant governor of Maryland. I think we believe that we don't have to agree with everything, but we can certainly agree that we can talk to one another. We can develop a curriculum that all young people can appreciate the American heritage, can appreciate the importance of getting involved, knowing that there are three parts of government, that each of us should respect one another. If, for instance, the Congress of the United States tells the executive branch, give us the right information, the executive branch should produce it. That's an issue that, for instance, has just come up. Maybe people around the United States should know what the issues are, so it doesn't come as a surprise.
I have to ask you about your family, which has been had a huge impact in American politics, as you alluded to. What is it like being with maybe the most famous family in America?
There is politics, there is pressure, high expectations, always. And, you know, I think for some of us, that's been good. The high expectations have been very helpful. And for others, it's been very tough. And I think that's the truth. And what I would say is I'm very grateful for what our family has contributed to our country. Today, Robert Putnam was saying that when John Kennedy said, ask not what you can do for the country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, he said, I thought he was talking directly to me, and I've devoted my life to seeing what I can do for my country. I'm very proud of that.
Kathleen Kennedy Townsend is the former Lieutenant Governor of Maryland and the daughter of Robert Kennedy. And you're listening to the show. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. The company formerly known as Weight Watchers has rolled out a new app aimed at kids. Called Curbo, the app will help children track what they eat, how much they exercise, and how much weight they lose. It'll use what's known as the traffic light system, dividing foods into red, yellow, and green categories, depending on how healthy they are and how frequently kids should be eating them. But the app has led to criticism from some who argue it could be dangerous to kids. With me to talk more about this is Angela Lamond. She's a registered dietitian nutritionist and a national spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And Angela, what is the balance for parents, especially in terms of keeping tabs of what their kids are eating while making sure they have a healthy relationship with food?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because this is a lot more of a complex issue than it seems on the surface. And the best things that we can do as parents, and I'm a mom of two, is to just live out the healthy lifestyle aspects more than we talk about it. So a lot of times we want to talk and teach our kids, but really the biggest lesson is living it out.
More of a, you want to show your kids that you are eating healthy foods as opposed to just telling them to eat healthy foods.
Yes, the whole family. I mean, and it's more than just the food too. I mean, being healthy includes so many other things other than just food, but certainly the child is often a product of their environment. So the foods that are supplied in the house are going to be the foods that they eat. And if you just eat it versus just talking about it, the problem is that there's a lot of parents that really don't have it straight in their own mind. So they're trying to navigate it at the same time.
What are some of the dangers of that? I mean, for example, parents who are sugar conscious or carb conscious or, you know, really tracking what they eat. I mean, is there a danger of their kids maybe seeing or hearing too much of that and creating their own fears or worries in their own heads?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, eating is such a basic part of being a human being. And everything that we do should be empowering kids. And, you know, we want them to be confident with eating when their body tells them that they need to eat and that whenever they eat, they're going to be able to get enough. And so when those things are kind of infringed upon, then things can happen. So if we're really harping on, you know, carbs and sugar and all of these things to the detriment of really, you know, stripping that confidence away from the child, then we start not helping, we start harming.
In families, though, where there is childhood obesity or the kids are maybe not following the parents quite as much as the parents would like in terms of eating healthy, what are the best ways for parents to address that, again, while still balancing and not, you know, shaming their kids or making their kids feel bad or have them gain an unhealthy relationship with food?
Well, there is a tried and true thing that we can do when it comes to the approaches of feeding and eating with our children. The parents have a responsibility and the kids have the responsibility. So if we stay in charge of the what, when, and how of eating, which means that we supply all the quality foods that we want to in our home, we put structure in our home when, you know, meals are prepared and eaten, snacks, the kitchen is open, the kitchen is closed. And then when it is time to eat, what we need to make sure that we do is we allow our children to eat as much as they feel like they need to eat. And that can be oversimplified, but if we kind of tell them that they need to eat more when their body's telling them they've had enough or vice versa, then that really starts disrupting the natural flow of feeding and eating.
Yeah, you don't want necessarily to encourage members of the Clean Plate Club anymore.
No, we don't. And we know that that does not work. And that can actually set you up for disrupting that just natural ability to know when you're full and when you've had enough. So, and we get it on the other side too. In my private practice in the Dallas area, we get kids that are underweight. So the parents are so concerned about them being underweight that they make them eat even whenever they're not hungry. And in that instance, we are still consistent in saying we don't want to do that, because we want them to be able to still follow what their body is telling them.
It's interesting you brought that up, because I think that's sort of an underreported and under-talked about concept, especially with all the childhood obesity discussion going on. But there are certainly kids who are underweight who need to put on weight to be healthy. I wonder if it's the same. It sounds like it is kind of the same approach in terms of getting them to eat when they're hungry, but maybe just sort of changing the kinds of things they're eating. Is that right?
Absolutely. Well, and making sure, I mean, some kids are not, you know, having regular meals and snacks, you know, depending on the age, you don't want them to go too long without eating. And sometimes, a lot of times that is the case with these underweight kids. You know, we believe as pediatric specialists that we should be feeding all of our children the same. It doesn't matter what size or shape. And that is the biggest misconception, is that if my child is, quote, skinny, then he can eat all the junk food he wants because he needs to, quote, gain weight. But I have this other child that's a little bit overweight, and therefore he shouldn't be eating all that the thin one is. And we see this time and time again. Eating patterns should be the same. It doesn't matter what size or shape you are.
What is the appropriate age for kids to start sort of being responsible and maybe keeping track of what they are eating as opposed to having their parents do it?
Well, I think that is very individualized, and that's really cuts at the core of my concern with the Curbo app, is that it does not take the individual child. I am not naive to think that every single child has the capacity to develop an eating disorder, but at the same time, I have seen enough children over the years that they are so different, and we have to be very careful when we discuss this, and that some kids really should never be tracking their food and monitoring their food.
Angela Lamond is a registered dietitian nutritionist and a national spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics.
On Veterans Day, we remember those who have sacrificed to protect and serve our country. To honor them, we bring you a story of one World War II veteran who shined a light during a dark time. From the Fronteras Desk in Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
His whole life, Howard Weisling wanted to be a comic strip artist. But in December 1941, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and Weisling felt compelled to enlist. He trained to be an aircraft mechanic with the Army in Gila Bend.
We tell stories about putting the tools in water to keep them cool enough to handle, and then you would have to dump out the water because the water would get too hot to touch.
Mike Weisling is Howard's grandson. He loved to hear his grandfather's war stories.
He probably told me a lot of stories that were not appropriate for a child to hear.
Mike says after flight engineer training, Howard was promptly shipped off to Europe. On his maiden flight, his plane was shot down over Austria. Mike has a memento of that event hung on his wall in Flagstaff.
So this right here is the ripcord that my grandfather pulled when he bailed out over Austria in December of 1944.
The entire crew of eight men landed safely in Austria, but a farmer found them and turned them over to a prisoner of war camp in Barth, Germany. Howard's son Morgan Weisling says it was freezing in northern Germany and the men almost starved to death.
The only thing they were fed was the garbage of the German soldiers. They would come and open the door and throw the stuff that was left over on their plates onto the floor of the barracks.
Hungry and homesick, Weisling coped the only way he knew how. He drew a comic strip. The book, Cigarette Wrappers Bound Together with Scrap Metal, was sent around camp.
And this is the story he would tell me all my life. And he'd say, yeah, I would do one panel of the story, and then it would get passed around the whole camp and eventually make it back, and he'd do another segment of the story, and that would get sent around. And this would just go on, you know, for months. It kept the morale of everybody up because they had something to look forward to.
After an entire year of this, they woke one morning to find their guards gone. They fled before the Russians arrived to liberate the camp. Howard finally got to go home. Just lucky to get out alive, he left the book behind. Back home in California, Howard soon had a wife and kids to feed, so he had to set aside his dream of becoming an artist and took a job as a gardener instead. Morgan was the youngest of three siblings.
He was a different kind of a guy with me than he was with my brother and sister. I think they got the father who was still fresh from the POW experience.
Morgan also shared his father's artistic gifts. Howard lived for the nights when Morgan would crawl upon his knee and he'd teach him to draw.
He would draw some cartoons and I would copy exactly what he would do. I still have all those sketchbooks.
Howard lived to see his son realize his dream of becoming a successful artist. Morgan is known as one of America's top contemporary painters today. That's how, 7 decades after the war, a stranger in New York was able to find him online.
I got this email out of the blue that said, I'm a retired businessman from New York, and I think I have something that might belong to you.
The man said one of his business partners embezzled a lot of money from their company.
And he went out and bought a truckload of Nazi artifacts before we could catch them. So we couldn't get the money back. All we had was this truckload of Nazi artifacts. And we're Jewish.
The truck contained three of Hitler's watercolor paintings, billy clubs, and his father's comics, with Howard's name engraved on the cover.
How did they end up in a truck with Hitler's watercolors when he was just a lowly POW? How did it end up in this truck?
Several days later, when it arrived by FedEx, Morgan couldn't believe it.
I cried more, and I hate to say this, than even when my father died. He had died previously, like 7 years before this. All I could think of is if my dad was still alive, this would have killed him, because he would have been just as shocked as we are.
Today, Morgan keeps the book in a safe deposit box.
I'm afraid. If my house were to burn down, that's the first thing I would be like, oh, no! I try to keep them under lock and key because they're just so valuable to us.
Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast. Thank you.